Literally from the North Shore presents Dean Hovey's book Whistling Sousa in 14 episodes. This is episode 13. Which was controlled chaos with a house in disarray, a garden overgrown with weeds, and a lawn that was patchy and always in need of mowing. I looked at Jenny and wondered if people from such different worlds could ever be happy together. The doorbell rang as we were clearing the table, and Jeremy ran to answer it while the rest of us carried dishes to the kitchen, contrary to the insistence of Barbara, who wanted them left so she could deal with them after the company was gone. I was walking back to the dining room when Jeremy came nearly running down the hallway with a brown-haired girl in tow. "Peter, Abby Finch is here to see you," he declared, pulling her forward and almost pushing her into my arms. "She wants to talk to you about the piccolo part of the concert." Poor Abby, with her plain, acne-covered face turning bright red, swatted at Jeremy's hand when he tried to push her toward me. "Mr. Rogers, I was wondering if you could help me with the piccolo part of the march." She hesitated for a second and then added softly, "But if you're busy, I'll just go home and practice some more." I waved her into the dining room and asked her to take the piccolo out of the case. While she did that, I took out my guitar. "Run through a scale for me," I said, and then I followed her notes with the guitar. She was a little sharp, so we talked through a tiny twist to get on pitch and then did the scale again. "Now, I'll play a few bars leading up to the piccolo solo, and then you play the solo while I play the tuba part on guitar in the background," I said. I was suddenly aware that the household had gathered at the dining room door. I played a few bars, but Abby was a half beat late starting her solo. I let her play through it, and I stopped playing after she ended her trill. "That was pretty good," I said. "You need to catch the downbeat to start the solo and then hold the trill at the end for a full four beats." She nodded and turned to leave. "Wait, we're going to do it again," I said. I played the same opening bars, and this time she was right on the beat and she held the trill. "Perfect," I said. Jenny clapped, and suddenly there was a round of applause and Abby blushed. "Are you all set now?" I asked. Abby shook her head. "I don't want to play it alone. I won't do a solo. If no one plays with me, I'm not coming to the concert." I could see the determination, or maybe stage fright, in her eyes. She said, "Mrs. Carvenan told me she gave you a piccolo a couple of days ago, but everyone in the school band says you can't learn to play a piccolo in a few days. They keep telling me that this is my big chance to shine, but I don't want to be embarrassed in front of the whole town. I told Mr. Johnson, the tuba player, to make sure you had the music." Although she said it softly, her determination showed through her nervousness. "Can I borrow your piccolo?" I asked. She readily handed it to me, and I drew a deep breath before playing the whole piccolo part of Stars and Stripes Forever. Abby and Jenny's whole family were silent when I finished. I handed the piccolo back to Abby and asked, "Did I do okay?" She broke into a shy smile and took her piccolo back. "You're pretty good. I bet you've been practicing piccolo longer than 4 days." "Lots longer," I lied. "Are we ready for a piccolo duet tomorrow night?" I got a silent nod, and she recased the piccolo before she let Jeremy take her back to the front door. Howard came over and clapped me on the back. I never would have dreamt that someone could play Stars and Stripes Forever on a guitar. "Any song is just a string of notes, and if you can play the notes, you can play the song." I played the opening bars of the Tennessee Waltz and let that morph into the Piano Man. Howard and Barbara were rapt. Jenny stood back and smiled while I impressed her parents. "You could be professional," Barbara said. "I am professional," I replied. Whistling Pines pays me to put on programs, and part of that job is playing guitar or piano. But Barbara started. I cut her off. There are a few musicians who make good money, but most of them work at it part-time and have some other job like waiting tables or tending bar to pay the rent, I explained. I get to make a living and play some music, too. It's about perfect. Jenny slid between her parents and gave me a hug. It was a flagrant public display of affection for her subdued family, but both Howard and Barbara smiled. Barbara had let her guard down in front of me. That was proven when I packed up my guitar and went to the front door. After I tied my shoes, Barbara did what I once regarded as the unthinkable. She gave me another quick hug. Not close, not for more than 1 second, but our relationship was obviously forever changed. Jenny walked with me to the car and pulled me close after I'd put the guitar in the back seat. "I think you got a new fan tonight," she said before giving me a lingering kiss. "Your mom let her guard down." I don't think there are 5 people outside the immediate family who have ever seen my mother without her makeup. "You are in the honored minority," she hesitated and then added, "or else you're part of the family." There was an unspoken question with the comment, and the whole evening had me a little mentally off balance. I was shaken by Barbara's sudden transformation, and Howard had made it clear through his warmth and actions that he was ready to accept me. Jeremy was, well, himself, a typical harebrained kid who seemed to respect and appreciate me. I was about to suggest that we go shopping for a diamond ring once the concert was behind me when the mood was broken. "Mom," Jeremy yelled from the front door, "I'm stuck on problem 4. Just kiss him and come help me." Jenny knew something had changed, too. She stepped on her tiptoes and gave me a warm, slow kiss. It wasn't our usual peck and goodbye, nor was it a high school French kiss with probing tongues that weren't quite sure where to go. It was more of a, "I love you dearly and we really don't need to indulge in childish gyrations anymore," kiss. She squeezed my hand and put her head against my shoulder. "I want to have a baby with you someday." Then she pushed away, and I saw a twinkle in her eye that made me wonder if she'd said it just because she knew that comment alone would keep me from sleeping. Whistling Sousa, Chapter 26, Thursday. I was still full of pot roast when I awoke, so I went through my morning shave and shower routine and jumped into the car without making coffee or eating breakfast. Wendy was already working on a crossword puzzle when I got to the dining room. Barbie was carefully pulling petunias out of a linen bag and arranging them in vases on the tables. I wondered if they were from her own garden. Angie LaFont came crashing through the kitchen door looking for someone. Her eyes locked on me and she stalked over. "Someone has to deal with Miriam," she demanded. I was torn between asking why she was telling me about it or saying something flippant when I sensed her seriousness. "What's the problem?" I asked. "She keeps having these hot flashes and she stops whatever she's doing and runs into the freezer." "How is that a big problem?" Angie let out a sigh. "Don't you understand? The kitchen is like a machine with all of the parts working together. If you have a part that keeps running into the freezer to cool off, the other parts get out of sync." "But you're the head cook," I protested. "Why don't you talk to her?" "Because I have to keep working with her and she likes you better." Angie quickly disappeared into the kitchen. Now I really needed coffee. "Peter," Wendy yelled from the far side of the dining room, "I need a 3-letter word for a Turkish hat." "F-E-Z," I replied. Miriam flew out of the kitchen like a rocket. "Angie said you wanted to talk to me about some problem." There was fire in her eyes, and I set my cup down and hung my head. I steered her toward the door leading to the lawn. Wendy and Barbie were both trying to look suspiciously disinterested. As we passed through the door, I could see the pink rising on Miriam's neck. She suddenly shed her apron and opened the top buttons of her white blouse. She started flapping the apron like a fan. "Hot flash?" I asked. "They're driving me nuts. I get hot and sweat, then I get chilled. The only thing that helps is running into the walk-in freezer until they pass." "Actually, that's what Angie wanted me to talk to you about. You're disrupting the flow." "Disrupting the flow? She doesn't want me stripping off clothes or sweating all over the food, so I don't have any option except sticking my head in the freezer," Miriam paced as she ranted. "Tell me about Sheila O'Keefe," I suggested, changing the topic. "What's to tell? She's an oversexed exhibitionist who has a reputation that would embarrass a two-bit whore." "Is her reputation real?" "What's real in this town is whatever people think is real," Miriam replied. "Miriam, you're the one person I can trust to give me an honest answer that's not slanted by opinion. What do you really know about Sheila?" Miriam became pensive and stared at me as if she was deciding how much she could trust me. "This is a true tidbit, and I'll share it with you only because I know you'll never repeat it." She waited until I'd nodded assent. "Sheila has two sides. She has all the flashy outfits, the toned and tanned body, and flirts with the men in town. The other side of Sheila is very quiet and secretive. She lives in a big old house on the east end of Duluth with a high fence and a gated driveway. Other than the price of a house like that, I guess it doesn't surprise me too much," I said. "Sheila lives with a girlfriend." "I suppose that makes some sense, just from a safety standpoint," I replied. Miriam gave me the slow child look. "Her girlfriend is her life partner. The heterosexual stuff with the guys is just bluster." I was skeptical. "How would you know that?" "Craig and I took a trip to Branson, Missouri a couple of years ago. We stayed in an Econo Lodge, and every morning I'd see this nice, pretty girl coming out of the room next to ours, and we'd chat while we walked down to the Continental Breakfast Buffet. She'd pick up a couple rolls and coffee and take them back to her room. The walls were a little thin, and every night we'd hear her howling like a beagle while she was in the throes of ecstasy. One evening we came back from a show at the Andy Williams Theater, and there was the pretty little thing walking arm in arm down the motel hallway with Sheila. Sheila wasn't sure who we were at first, but at some point over the next couple days, her friend told her that we were from Minnesota and she must have connected us to two harbors. The next time I saw Sheila, she steered me into a ladies' room and begged me not to out her." "And you haven't?" "I haven't, and neither will you. I have a few skeletons in my closet, so I understand and respect her wishes. The only reason I'm telling you is because this whole stupid thing about her getting poisoned is getting way out of hand. There are some suspicious wives and some lecherous men who have ideas, but Sheila hasn't been bedding or stealing any husbands. She flirts and flatters, but she doesn't go beyond. You can bank on that." With this sudden new perspective on Sheila, I went back to my office with a whole new range of motives, from scorned girlfriends to someone who got outed because of her association with Sheila. The poisoning fit better with a female attacker, and this news about Sheila's sexual orientation suddenly seemed quite pertinent. As soon as I sat down, Wendy blew into my office. "I've been thinking about plagiarism," she said as she edged me out of the desk chair. She sat down, entered my not-so-secret password, and then pulled up thesaurus.com and entered the word plagiarize. A page popped up with the proper pronunciation, saying it is a verb, and the definition, to forge. Following that were a list of synonyms. I stood behind her, looking over her shoulder, reading the list. Fake, forge, copy, mimeograph, mirror, reflect, Xerox, steal, use, and usurp were listed with dozens of others. Hulda had the word wrong, but did she have the meaning right? I asked. Sometimes she gets a homophone that sounds right but means something totally different, like when she said philatelist but meant philanderer. Wendy's fingers hovered over the keyboard before pulling up Google and searching for homophones of plagiarize. There's nothing here except some short phrases that end with eyes. Lying eyes, evil eyes. Oh, wait, here's simonized. Do you think Sheila simonized someone? I doubt it, but I don't even know what simonize means. Again, her fingers flew over the keys. Simonize. To polish a car or to apply wax to a car. Do you think she polished someone? Wendy gave me a suggestive leer. Maybe she just polished one part of someone or someone's husband. Maybe she botched someone's wax job. Am I interrupting something? The question came from a third voice. I spun around and found Nancy standing at my door. No, we're just trying to figure out what Hulda Packer meant when she said someone had plagiarized something. Why don't you ask her when you drive the van to Betty's Pies? She's sitting in the front row of the van, waiting for a driver. I looked at my watch and realized I was 5 minutes late for the Thursday afternoon field trip to the pie shop. It was a popular event, and we always had a van filled with people looking forward to the outing. I sprinted for the front lobby, leaving Wendy to explain why she was sitting at my computer reading the thesaurus webpage. I was sure Wendy would come up with a plausible explanation that would implicate me and exonerate her. The trip to Betty's Pies was pure chaos, and I never got a chance to talk with Hulda about Sheila's plagiarizing. Betty's was very busy, and we had to split the group among several tables spread throughout the restaurant. I was forced to walk back and forth, assisting with menu choices, finding lost reading glasses, searching for a lost wallet, and helping an octogenarian to the bathroom. By the time we got back to Whistling Pines and unloaded, it was time for me to drive home, change into my white and black outfit, then rush to the band shell. I closed the door to my office as the sweet smell of honey Cavendish tobacco wafted around me. I'm really in a hurry, Len, I said, without the need to look. I heard Tinker Oldham was moved out of the ICU today, so I stopped in to see if he remembered anything about the afternoon he was bumped, Len said, fiddling with his unlit pipe. A funny thing happened while I was there. A teenage kid showed up with a bouquet of flowers he'd picked from his mother's garden. He stammered through an explanation of shooting the rubber band at the bull without looking up and handed Tinker an apology note. His father was standing behind him and nudged him. The kid was sweating bullets and staring at his shoes, but he told Tinker that when his 4-H calf sold, he'd pay for the hospital costs Medicare didn't cover. Interesting story, I said, checking my watch to make sure I still had plenty of time to make it home and change. I talked with the father who told me about some young guy with a crew cut who figured out what had happened and confronted his son. I got the feeling the kid's sudden remorse had something to do with you. I couldn't help but smile. Are you going to tell the sheriff you solved the bull-kicking crime? Len asked. I don't see any point, I said, checking my watch again. It seems like justice has been served. If the sheriff ever finds out you solved the case and his department didn't get credit for solving the crime, he'll be PO'd. Are you going to tell him? I asked. Len fiddled with his pipe, then put the stem in his mouth. It's not my place to say anything to him, and I doubt the kid will either. Then the case is closed. Len was smiling and shaking his head as I rushed for the parking lot. Whistling Sousa, Chapter 27. I found a parking spot on the block behind the band shell and said hello to the musicians who were filtering across the park. The doors leading to the storage room beneath the stage floor were open. I walked down the narrow steps to the basement storage area and headed toward the cacophony of voices and the clatter of instrument cases and folding chairs. I was unsurprised to find Brian Johnson regaling the group of middle-aged musicians with tuba jokes. He delivered his punchline and rushed over to shake my hand. "Doc, glad you made it a little early. There are some things you need to deal with." I'd prefer Peter to being called Doc. "Whatever you prefer, but word has been circulating that your nickname is Doc, Doc," Brian said as he led me back up the stairs and onto the stage. "We have a shortage of chairs." I looked at the stage and the three rows of chairs. "I don't understand." "We put out all the chairs, and there aren't enough for all the musicians," Brian explained. "We're short three chairs." "Are you missing some?" "Not really. It's just that a few of them are old and a little shaky, and we're getting an unprecedented number of alumni members for the year-end concert." "What are alumni members?" "Your name is entered in a logbook before your first practice with the band. That makes you an official band member until your obituary appears in the Lake County News Chronicle. When you move away or stop playing, you become an inactive alumnus, but we welcome back anyone who has an instrument and wants to play." Not having time to process the information, I pointed at the Lutheran church across the street. "Find a couple of the younger members and borrow chairs from the church." Brian led me back down the stairs and introduced me to Pastor Ralph Kittison. "Pastor, we'd like to borrow chairs to seat the extra alumni who show up for tonight's concert." The pastor tapped a couple of the teen band members. "The back door isn't locked. We need three chairs." He turned back and asked, "Is there anything else I can do?" I smiled. "What instrument do you play, Pastor?" "I play this battered old clarinet," he said, holding up his instrument for my inspection. I took it gently and turned it from end to end, noting a few dings. "I've never seen this construction before, but based on my education, I'd guess this is BTR. The pastor was smiling as I passed the clarinet back to him. He said, "You're probably the only other person in Two Harbors who can recognize bithermal reinforced grandilla. I suppose you also recognize the Konstuhl tuba that Brian Johnson plays." I watched as Brian gently lifted his tuba from its case. Unlike most of the other brass instruments that had a slight patina from age, the tuba reflected like a mirror with a slight reddish hue. Brian handed it to me. Konstuhl is a relatively new company in Anaheim, California that has rediscovered the value of adding a little more copper to their brass, which gives the instrument a little mellower sound. I was impressed, knowing that the modern mass-produced instruments played notes, but the older instruments, or those made from old technology, added a special resonance to their music. "Play your heart out, Brian," I said, then headed for the stairs. Outside, I found John Carr leaning against a tree behind the band shell. "John, I'd like to take you into my confidence." "Don't sweat it, Peter," he said. "You'll do fine tonight. The band is well rehearsed, and you'll be proud of us." I smiled. "Thank you, but I have another issue." I looked around and saw dozens of people carrying folding lawn chairs and blankets. Miriam and her husband were setting up lawn chairs near an old cannon in the middle of the park, and Tucker, the homely dog she'd adopted after his Whistling Pines owner died, was sniffing the wheels of the cannon before lifting his leg on it. That done, he found a black lab puppy a few feet away, and the two of them started tumbling in the grass, nipping at each other's ears. Everywhere there were old neighbors reconnecting and children playing. I had an overwhelming feeling I'd become part of the community. Near the east end of the bandshell, a string of older women were dragging old wooden lawn chairs across the grass. As they set them up, I saw Dolores, who gave me a discreet nod. They sat, and although the evening was still warm, they spread blankets and crocheted afghans across their laps. A few musicians were by the bandshell door, smoking their last cigarettes before the concert. John, I'm worried about Sheila O'Keefe. I'm afraid someone might try to hurt her again tonight. Oh my, he replied. Have there been threats? I'm not aware of any specific threats, but whoever arranged the first attack is still out there. You sit next to her. Please keep an eye on her. I'm uniquely prepared for that responsibility, he said, sliding back the tail of his jacket. Hanging on his belt was a pistol in a holster. I have a concealed carry permit for my gun. I don't think you'll have to shoot anyone or throw your body in front of her. Just make sure someone doesn't slip another peanut into her reed case. You don't think that wasn't just a terrible practical joke? He asked, letting the jacket slide over the holster, disguising it well. There are a few theories, and most make me believe the attack was more than that. Sheila has more detractors than supporters, and I think someone took their dislike for her a little too far. She's a bit of an enigma, John replied. As the director, I am like a counselor for some of the musicians. Sheila and I have had a few discussions. Two Harbors isn't a friendly place for her. I think she may have moved to Duluth after one of our heart-to-heart discussions. It's hard to live an alternative lifestyle in a small town. John gave me a knowing look, and I admitted, yes, I know she's a lesbian. On the other hand, I think that secret is well guarded and probably not what's behind this. The clatter of footsteps on the stairs, chairs scraping, and the sounds of instrument tuning started behind us. John glanced at his watch. Showtime, he said, limping up the steps with one hand on my shoulder and the other on his alto saxophone. At the top of the stairs, he paused and straightened up. You worry about the band. Sheila is in my safe hands for tonight. We walked to the band shell, and I made a quick search of the stage and wings, looking for Sheila. Abby, my fellow piccoloist, seated between the two flutists, gave me a nervous wave. I patted my pocket to show her that I had the piccolo and realized I'd left it at home. Jenny's family was seated near the street in a row of captain's chairs, and I tried to get her attention by waving discreetly. When that failed, I flailed my arms and quickly realized that the conversation they were having with the families sitting next to them was more absorbing, so I leaped down from the stage and ran across the park, dodging chairs, children, and a dachshund who wanted to playfully grab my pants cuff. Jenny, I said breathlessly, I need you to drive back to my house and get the piccolo from the kitchen table. But the concert starts in like 3 minutes. I pointed my thumb over my shoulder. I know, but Abby Finch expects me to play a piccolo duet with her in the last song. I turned and watched Abby talking excitedly with the flutists on the stage. Oh, crap, Jenny said, gathering her linen bag. Jeremy, stay with Grandpa and Grandma. Sheila was climbing the stairs to the stage, her bassoon hanging from a strap around her neck. She was dressed in black slacks and a white blouse that was less revealing than her outfit from the county fair, but still left a lot of cleavage showing. The past 2 weeks' episodes of this program can be listened to from the ktwh.org website. Simply click on Literally from the North Shore from the program's drop-down menu found at the top of the homepage to listen to the archived shows.